Hi, and welcome back to our special podcast series on COP28. I'm Heather Dinwoodie, and I'm joined again by Julia Bataro and Felicia Jackson. So Felicia, perhaps you could tell us what you've been up to the last couple of days, because you're on the ground in Dubai.
Yeah, it's been very interesting here. There's an awful lot going on. It's very difficult to stay on top of every announcement that comes out. The thing to remember at this stage is that what we're looking for is to get the negotiators to get text prepared for ministers to discuss. So while we have a lot of news, we've had announcements about the tripling up and doubling down, so tripling targets for renewable energy, doubling targets for energy efficiency. There's been a lot of announcements. There's not that much that's concrete. We did get the agenda agreed on the first day, which is remarkable. And we got approval of the loss and damage fund, which is really, really powerful. I think the last note I saw was that 87 billion in climate finance has been agreed. But I think it's really important to note that a lot of those announcements refer to commitments, to amounts that are going to be mobilized by the use of finance. So at this point, it's really not clear quite how much money is going to be available. One of the things I was quite excited about was the Global Cooling Pledge, where countries got together to actually take action on the increasing demand for cooling, not just for air conditioning, but also for medicine. I think that's going to be incredibly important. And, you know, we do at least have the phrase, the phase out of fossil fuels in the draft text. But there are, you know, that's a long way away from actually getting something agreed. There are still countries that are uncomfortable about it. We saw earlier this week the oil and gas decarbonization charter, which is, you know, a move in the right direction, oil and gas companies taking emissions reduction seriously. But it's a challenge when you think about the fact that it includes the repackaging of existing voluntary commitments. It doesn't include scope 3. It's a positive move and a sign that the industry is taking action, but somehow it all feels a little bit too little and a little bit late.
I mean, I hate to say this, and I hope I don't get in trouble for it, but to me, there's almost just a blatant lack of honesty even in the name of that. Because you can say, you know, I am fully on board with fossil fuel companies doing everything they can to reduce their carbon, but decarbonization, I mean, that's a contradiction in terms, really.
Yeah, I think you read sometimes that a company, an oil company, would claim that their oil and gas is carbon neutral because they offset it somehow, or they're planning to capture their carbon and stuff. And it's like, real carbon neutrality will be not having the oil and gas in the first place. Ultimately, this is all putting plasters on the problem.
Yeah. Don't forget, though, that a huge part of the challenge is the terms we use and how we define them. And I think, you know, that's one of the challenges there's been in the voluntary carbon markets. There's still quite a long way to go on the current negotiations. But one of the interesting things has been the launch of a methodology for transition credits. So actually using the carbon markets to facilitate the early offlining of coal-fired power plants, for example. Now, for anyone in the climate space, that's a bit challenging. But it is a really positive move towards getting these things on the off-ramp.
I was just going to say, I actually love that idea, because I feel like, you know, even if we're talking about renewable energy, if we talk about wind energy as being zero carbon, sure, the energy itself is. But, you know, when we start thinking about the management of the grid, when we start thinking about like the building, the construction and waste of turbines, the mining for the minerals and metals that goes into it, I almost get really fed up of the terminology we're using at the moment, because I don't think it's helpful to label things in a way that just isn't honest. It sounds good, but it isn't honest. And I think this idea of transition credits is about viewing things as a process and saying, okay, we are here now. Here's where we're going. Like, we're doing better. And to me, that seems a lot more positive than just slapping a sticker on something that, you know, immediately begins to peel away when someone nosy like me sticks their nose in it.
That's a great metaphor. Sorry.
Thank you.
I loved it.
But I also I think you're right, but I also think it's a really useful way of dealing with a lot of the challenges that exist in emerging markets, with that shift of often coal-fired power. And hopefully it will become part of the lexicon moving forward. I think what's really interesting about what you said, I did an interview with Bertrand Piccard, who runs the Solar Impulse Foundation, and he's actually come up with an entirely new lexicon for how we should talk about climate change to sort of change the way in which we focus on it. Instead of decarbonisation, look at it as modernisation, and just change the framing of the conversation so that everyone can take part. And it doesn't have to be this binary good, bad, which is unfortunately what does tend to happen to a great extent during the COP. People feel very strongly about the position that they have and they want to defend it. And I think it's very challenging for negotiators when that binary conversation puts a country on the back foot. So, you know, I'm going to write about that so you'll be able to pick up on it on the site. But it's a really interesting idea and I think really well worth paying attention to.
I'm nodding in agreement here, and I'm aware that no one can really see me. It doesn't work so well on a audio media. But I suppose it would be, you know, as much as we can say, like, concrete labels aren't necessarily helpful. One of the first things you mentioned, Fee, was that we're awaiting concrete text. We want concrete action. And you mentioned briefly the global stocktake, and I wondered if we could maybe expand on that for our audience.
Well, I think what's important about the global stocktake is it's going to set out the boundaries for what is expected for the next set of NDCs, so nationally determined contributions. So the frameworks that countries set to decide what they're going to be doing during the next period. What's interesting about it is it's got an awful lot of language in it, which might sound like a weird thing to say, but there's so many different options within the text that we need to actually, well, what the negotiators are trying to do is narrow down what can be agreed and, you know, what won't be agreed, trying to work out what the different red lines from different parties are. So an awful lot is going to hinge on the final text. What actually is said about fossil fuels in moving forward? What is actually agreed about the potential reform of financial architecture? So freeing up the flows of finance towards climate action. And one of the things that I'm most interested in is the language on nature and whether or not nature is included in NDCs. So we all know that the Global Biodiversity Framework was agreed last December. But if you think about it, we've got this growing understanding of the fact that biodiversity and nature are fundamentally interconnected with climate, not just because of the impact on nature and biodiversity of climate change and extreme weather, but the ways in which the protection of nature can actually build resilience and protect against the worst ravages of climate change, the need to keep soil healthy and water systems functioning. So Germany and Colombia got together, and I think they were supported by Sierra Leone in calling for nature to be included in the global stocktake and included in action on NDCs. I think it's a very polarizing topic because it's still fairly early in the development of the GBF. And obviously, what I think is interesting is there's going to be a conversation between the two conventions at some point in the next few days. I'm not sure what's going to come out of it. But the potential for having sort of common frameworks and metrics for states and for companies to understand how to monitor and measure and manage their impact on the climate and on nature could be absolutely transformational.
I mean, I feel that talking about, like, if the global stocktake was exclusively about emissions, it really feels like it should have happened decades ago. I think last year saw a real momentum in understanding how nature and climate are going together. And, you know, if the global stocktake tells us how to act for the next 5, 6, 10 years, then, well, shouldn't we really be talking about nature? I mean, are we going to address this in the next global stocktake? I think it would be way too late.
And I think I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying that Saturday will be a kind of nature-themed day at COP. So it'll be nature, oceans, forests, bring all that together. And we've already had, you know, there's been declarations on food and agriculture. There's been declarations on healthcare, which all these things that haven't really come into COP discussions in history. This is kind of, I mean, those were the first declarations of their kind, really. And I do think it's interesting to see that these three conventions that were kind of born at the same time, you had, you know, climate, you had nature, and then also the, I forget the full acronym for it, but the Convention Against Desertification.
United Nations Convention to Combat Desertification.
That's the one. Thank you. And yeah, I mean, all of these things kind of came, you know, they were born together and then just went their separate ways. And it does now seem that they are uniting once more, you could say. And you know, there's also, there's the need to look ahead as well, because I think a lot of the climate, and I'm talking specifically climate here, a lot of the climate conversation is about emissions, it's about decarbonization, it's about reducing emissions. But what we've been seeing this week, what we've been hearing from the world scientists, is that adaptation needs to happen and is currently not happening at anywhere near the scale or the rate that is needed. Because, you know, some level of climate change is already firmly locked in. And as the climate changes, there are all these different ecological tipping points that are passing. Well, they're tipping point. And, you know, at the end of the day, no matter what we do now, we also need to prepare for what is coming, whether we like it or not. And Felicia, I have been hearing some rumours of talks going on long into the night about adaptation with the view to eventually settling the global goal on adaptation. I wonder, have you got any insight on that on the ground?
To be perfectly honest, almost all conversations around the negotiating text tend to be fractious because people have very different ideas. What I would say is that while you're absolutely right that adaptation is critical, it's very hard to finance with the way things are currently structured. And a lot of the COP discussions are around finance. It's whether we cut off finance to something by deciding to phase out fossil fuels, whether we push finance towards something with mitigation or adaptation. I think the most important thing is actually this issue, as you say, of getting something done, because we've talked for many years about how we go about addressing the problem. That, as you say, there's so little time. We need to actually get implementation. As Julia says, we need to get questions of how you manage the implications and the knock-on effects of climate change on health, on food security. These are all things that are going to bite us very, very quickly. And there was a couple of days ago, the latest carbon budget report came out, which showed that, and you know, the carbon budget is the amount that was calculated under the Paris Agreement that would take us to 2050. And the calculations this year basically say, given the way emissions are rising, we will have used up all of that budget, all of the budget to get us to 1.5 degrees by the end of this decade. We need to take action and stop talking about whether we're going to do it or not.
Absolutely. And I hate to sound cynical, but I wonder if part of the reason that adaptation is proving to be such a sticking point is because the countries that typically are in the greatest and most urgent need of adaptation are the ones with the least resources, particularly financial resources, to do it themselves. And to me, the big sticking point seems to be, you know, deciding who's going to pay for it. And that's where we're running into issues. I wonder if you have any comments on that.
No, just a general sense of agreement. In the end, you move the money or you move nothing. Finance is what it all boils down to. It's who's going to pay for it, who's going to get the money, and how are you going to allocate responsibility? And responsibility is a very challenging word for a lot of people within the COP process. If you think about historical responsibility versus current responsibility, you know, the potential to allow an economy to grow. Well, you know, the global north, these economies have been growing for 200 years based on the Industrial Revolution. And someone said to me, what was it? Someone said today the thing about adaptation, speaking specifically, for example, about smallholder farmers, the issue is that the scale of the problem we face is another industrial revolution, but the speed at which we need it to take place is that of the digital revolution.
That is an interesting way of putting it, but I think it makes perfect sense. And on that note, we'll be wrapping up for today, but we'll be back with the third installment to come to our conclusions on COP28. So thanks again for listening, and please do like and subscribe to our channel for future episodes.